except you have a very complex refinery, you don't want the heavy blends, right? And it depends on the needs or the yield you want to get out of the refinery as well. But what happens is if yield is discovered, you have to carry out lots of studies. There are surveys, mappings. Then you drill one well, two. Some wells will be dry holes. It's risky. You do all of that, and eventually you're able to estimate how many barrels of hydrocarbon are in this reservoir. No one has the size of OPEC. OPEC is really influential. They do about, I would say, 40% of the entire demand of the world.
What are the particularities of these vessels? What you need to take into account to build this kind of ship?
The first thing you need to know is that...
Welcome to a new podcast episode. So today we are joined by Victor. So Victor, you are working in Sahara. Can you maybe introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, thank you very much, Paul. My name is Victor, and I'm 30 years old, so not so young, not so old. And I've been in the oil and gas industry for 8 years now. I work with Sahara Energy. Within this period, I've worked across different parts of the oil and gas industry. I started with business development and trading operations for crude oil, for petroleum products. At some point, for LPG and NGLs. And I had a little stint at refining as well.
Okay.
Before I moved into the marine space. So what I do now basically is I handle new builds, or I work with a team to handle new builds for my company, LPG vessels primarily. And we also maintain one or two offshore assets.
Okay, very interesting. So your journey started in West Africa.
Correct.
So you were born in Nigeria, if I'm correct.
Correct.
So can you explain a little bit at the beginning, the first of all, the maritime industry in West Africa, how it works, on the biggest challenges, on the things that people need to understand about this market?
Fantastic. Well, Nigeria is a big player in the West African space. I like to look at it sub-Saharan Africa. It makes a lot of sense because now I can include other big players like Angola, right? In the sub-Saharan African space, oil and gas is a thriving thing. It's a main source of the economy for several countries. And Nigeria is there. There's Congo, Congo Brazza. They're very active as well. Angola is a major producer there. So many other countries are also coming up with lots of new productions, sparing up in Senegal, in Ghana, in Guinea, Equatorial Guinea, so many of it. So it depends. We can take it on a case-by-case basis.
Okay. So I know that in West Africa, for example, we have many FPSO. It's quite common there to use FPSO. Can you explain maybe how it works, on why we have so many FPSO?
Yeah, FPSOs is a short form for floating, producing, storage, and offloading vessel, right? And the reason why we have FPSOs, an FPSO will be needed if it's an offshore production, right? And Nigeria, for example, a large proportion of the production is offshore. And some of them are located in deep, ultra-deep water, you know, 1,500 meters, 1,600, like the Egina. So for things like that, you need a custom vessel, an FPSO in this instance, to produce. It also serves as an export terminal. And you have that coming up in other parts of Africa as well. In Angola, you have FPSOs. And it helps to, you know, it's easier. You don't want to, Africa is very specific. Onshore production can have its peculiar challenges. And what you've seen in recent years is that the majors, oil and gas majors, are farming out, if I can use that term, or they are, you know, taking off shares or equities in the onshore assets, giving it to local players. That encourages local participation as well, while they are focusing more on deep water or ultra-deep water assets. So FPSOs are necessary. FSOs too are becoming a thing as well.
Okay, what are the differences between FSO and FPSO?
Thank you. The difference is the P there, which is for producing. So the FSOs are storage vessels. They are mostly existing VLCCs that has to be, you know, converted. They retrofit this in shipyards and make it capable of storing and exporting as well. So they receive the products either via pipelines or even ship to ship transfers, then store it, then they're able to also export it, tandem export, ship to ship, whichever arrangement works. But they don't produce. And that is a very massive difference in terms of cost, because you realize that the production component of FPSOs add it's a full factory. Okay. That's the way I look at it. It's like when you look at onshore assets or maybe refineries, it's a full factory. You have to produce this hydrocarbon and process it even. And yeah.
What are, do you know the major like oil fields in West Africa? Or like many, for example, Jubilee or in Ghana or this kind of these terms?
It's interesting that you're speaking about Jubilee in Ghana. Yeah, West Africa, they have some very notable oil fields. Sub-Saharan Africa, if I can say that. In Nigeria, for example, you have, I mentioned Egina here. Egina was discovered in 2003.
Okay.
And it was commissioned in 2018. So you can see already there's quite a window there. But what happens from discovery is that appraisal wells, you know, are drilled, and then, you know, you have to get your seismic data. But this field at some point, the reason I consider it massive is because at some point in 2019, it was doing as much as 200,000 barrels per day. So it's a really big field. There's the popular Forcados crude blend that is known in Nigeria as well. That is not a specific oil field. It's more like a terminal being handled by Shell. And you have a lot of oil fields feeding into a trunk line, and it's been exported there. But that's Nigeria. In places like Angola, for example, you have this massive project. If my memory doesn't fail me, I think it's called Combo with a K. And it's a complex with 6 different fields. And some of them are quite prolific. There's the Mostarda that produces, I think currently it does about 180,000 barrels per day, and it's massive.
They are close by, that's why they're combining all together. Because I know in Nigeria, you have different fields, but it's very close. I mean, in terms of distance, like in terms of miles, they are very close by. Yeah. So that's why maybe they combine all of them. Or
yeah, well, yes, proximity is one thing.
Mm-hmm.
The nature of the crude, or something that we like to call assay, is another thing. Because, for instance, if you have a blend, a Forcados blend, you would want it to maintain the same physical and chemical properties. So you don't get crude oil with that is distinctively different. Proximity is another important thing. It has to be around the same area. So you have a trunk line, typically you have a trunk line running, then it ties off to, you know, smaller pipelines to other fields, and then you aggregate and pick up this crude and transport it to a central terminal where it's exported. But the important thing is that the different components that feed into the blend should maintain the same chemical and physical properties for it to be part of the blend.
Okay, very interesting. In terms of type of crude oil and grade, like what can you say about it, and what difference do we have in Nigeria, for example? And we have as well this term API. I'm working on it as this term. So maybe can you elaborate? It's very interesting.
Very interesting question. API. The way I've thought about that is it's a diabolical term, if I can put it like that. But the formula is really weird. It's what everyone needs to know is specific gravity. And we know specific gravity is measuring density relative to water, right?
Yeah.
And API is used to specify how heavy or how light crude oil is. If the API number is high, it tells you that the crude is really light. If it's tending towards 10 or even below, because there are grades that could be that way, it's really heavy. So the formula is funny. It's 141.5 divided by the specific gravity of that crude minus 131.5. It's arbitrary. Don't ask me how it originated, okay, because I don't know. And that makes you, that gives you, if you just plot that in with water being the reference fluid, with a specific gravity of 1, that tells you that the API for water is 10. So any number of the API number for any crude above 10 is less dense than water, which means it's lighter. If it's closer to 10, you know you're dealing with a really heavy crude.
Okay. And why do we need to know about all this term about API? Why this is so important to know if the crude is very heavy or very light?
Oh yeah, extremely important because how heavy or how light a crude oil grade is sort of gives it value with refiners. It's a very important property. You see a world where a lot of it's not just how heavy or how light it is. There's also something called how sweet or how sour it is, which is the percentage composition of sulfur in it. Refiners don't they like to get the very light crude. I wouldn't say too light, but really light crude, because except you have a very complex refinery, you don't want the heavy blends. Right, and it depends on the needs or the yield you want to get out of the refinery as well. If you want gasoline, naphtha, that range, you would want to focus more on the light crude. But if you want maybe distillates, heavier fractions, a heavier crude grade would be better for you. If you have a very complex refinery that you've tuned to handle different grades, even better, you can have all types, blend it, and feed it into your CDU and start producing.
Okay, it's very interesting what you say. And I know in the sulfur as well is very important. High sulfur is not always welcome because for corrosion risks. And I know that, for example, in Middle East, there are most of the ref we have like very high sulfur crude oil, but refineries are big and have this capacity to improve the final product. But what do you want to say more about the quality of crude oil? And especially different part of the world, what are the different specificities, I would say.
Fantastic. Yes, sulfur. You did mention sulfur. Sulfur is very important. This we don't want sulfur in crude oil typically because it can damage process facilities, right? And hydrogen sulfide, it's toxic. It's a toxic gas. As much as possible, you want to treat. You would want to get crude oil that is not doesn't have a high composition of sulfur. But if you do get it, you would want to also make sure that your refinery is able to handle all of this. Regarding the different crude grades across the world, Nigerian crude, West African crude generally is known to be sweet. It means it has a little sulfur component. You see some of them having 0.3% by weight, 0.2, 0.3 something, right? But West Texas Intermediate, for example, is a light sweet crude in the US. Really light, low sulfur. You have some other parts of the world where the crude has quite a bit of sulfur. The Russian Urals is it has some sulfur and it's heavy and it has some sulfur in it. And there's this crude oil grade that's just new. I think it's the newest exportable grade in Africa from Senegal. It's called Sangoma. It has about 1% by mass sulfur content. So, well, refineries are happy. The complex ones are happy to receive them, but they are not going to be as, premium as the sweet and light crude grades.
Okay. Do you know maybe the biggest exporter of crude oil in West Africa on as well in the world for the audience?
In sub-Saharan Africa, in Africa, Nigeria is number one, right? There was a point in time where it lost that position to Angola. So, but currently, Nigeria does about 1.6 million barrels per day. And Angola does about 1.2. Now, all of this crude oil is not being exported, right? I'm sure you would have heard there's a big refinery that just came up in Nigeria and has been producing for a bit now. It's the Dangote refinery. Some of the crude oil, there's an agreement in place to feed them to the refinery because it's a very hungry CDU unit. It's 650,000 barrels, even though it's not running at full production, but that is a lot, right? And so all of Nigeria's crude, in terms of production, they're number one, but all of it cannot be exported. You have Angola there. In Africa, there is Libya. There's Algeria. These are export a lot, but my focus is on sub-Saharan Africa anyway. And yeah.
Ghana as well, no? Ghana, is it a big exporter?
I wouldn't say big. Ghana as a country does probably 250,000 barrels per day. There are two major export grades, Jubilee, like you
Yeah,
mentioned.
on 10.
But Ghana as a country, maybe not a very big exporter yet. Congo exports quite a bit. about the same volume as Ghana, maybe 250, 260 to 70,000 barrels per day, depending on what the production is like. They have a major grid, the Geno grid, and Geno is one grid that the Chinese love a lot. So, well, it's heavy.
Thank you.
And if it's heavy, that means it's likely to trade at a discount. And they have complex refineries that can handle that easily. So they get all the fractions all the way during the refining process.
That's very interesting what you said.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for West Africa, it's quite large, but as well, we have Middle East, of course, and it's the biggest with OPEC. It's a huge producer.
Yeah.
What else do we have?
In terms of?
Crude oil production, exporter.
In the world, the highest producers are the US.
Yeah.
Strange, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they're the highest producers. You've heard of shale oil, and they are producing a lot in the US. I think it's as much as 30 million barrels per day. Russia is probably the second highest producers now, even though they are now part of the OPEC Plus, right? And those, Russia, Saudi Arabia should be number three. Those two countries voluntarily are taking on cuts, you know, because OPEC wants to stabilize supply to handle, you know, prices. And those two countries are taking on cuts, which means the US is number one, I think Russia is number two, and Saudi Arabia is number three.
Okay, and what can you say? Interesting. What can you say about OPEC? Why do we have this group OPEC? What is the goal of it at the end?
A very interesting question. Now we're going into the field of geopolitics.
Yeah.
Right. exactly. OPEC, Organization for Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC was established in 1960 by five primary founding member countries, most of them from the Middle East, with the exclusion of Venezuela. Venezuela is from South America. But the idea was that prior to this time, before OPEC came in, price of crude oil was controlled by companies, by multinationals. They had this reference term, the Seven Sisters. And some of the nations, you know, that have these deposits of hydrocarbon felt like it was unfair. They needed to be represented fairly. So they came together and formed what is now OPEC. The idea would be to, you know, manage, coordinate policies for member countries to make sure crude oil sells at a fair price, right? Fair price. And to also ensure that there is a balance between supply and demand. So OPEC plays that kind of role. And now they are 12 members of OPEC currently, 12 primary members. Then you have 10 other countries that they have some form of agreement with. So OPEC is a significant player.
Okay. Is it the only one, for the oil industry, only one having this kind of group, I would say, or do we have something similar to OPEC in the world?
Oh, there are subgroups. There are regional groups scattered across. There is the Arab producing companies. There's that for Africa as well. There's also gas exporting companies forum. It's a similar, people call it OPEC for gas, right? But in terms of size and influence for producing countries specifically, no one has the size of OPEC. OPEC is really influential. They do about, I would say, 40% of the entire demand of the world. But on the other side, there is another organization, the International Energy Agency, the IEA. Well, this is mostly a forum for companies that consume. They are mostly developed countries that consume. But let that not deceive us, many of the countries there produce a lot as well. So there's that. Sometimes it looks like they're opposite each other on the spectrum, but they play key roles.
Okay,
very interesting. I know that you work as well with LPG.
Yeah.
I made a podcast about LPG, the previous episode.
Okay.
So I won't ask you the same questions because we already know. But what can you say about the process, how we produce oil? I mean, at the end, fuel, for example, especially in West Africa. We all know how it works in the big pictures, but You know more than most of people in this podcast and the audience, like how it works in West Africa, about when you take the crude oil until the end in refinery, like which refinery and all this in Nigeria, for example.
Okay, I think it would be prudent to paint a general picture first. Process for extraction and processing, which is refining and distribution for oil and gas, is robust. It's a lot. I happen to actually study petroleum engineering. So ideally, by, you know, study, I should focus more on the upstream sector, which is like the extraction. But what happens is a field is discovered, you have to carry out lots of studies. There are surveys, mappings, and then you drill one well, two. Some wells will be dry holes. It's risky. You do all of that. And eventually, you're able to estimate how many barrels of hydrocarbon are in this reservoir, for example. And then with that, you can decide, is it commercial? Is it not commercial? After you finish your drilling campaign, you now have to produce it. Now, the interface between completion of drilling and producing is what they call completion. They complete the well, you know, and make it ready for production. You can, if it's offshore, you get a vessel and produce. And when production is done, that is when crude oil is exported. Nobody uses crude oil. The real products have to, you know, be refined out of crude oil. And that is a very big, you know, space, refining. If the crude oil moves to, you can pick any refinery. You can use the ones in Nigeria. You can use the one anywhere in the world. It's all the same process, depending on the configuration. Crude oil comes in. The process is simple. Let's paint a simple picture. You heat it up. Refining is like distillation. You know how you put water, for instance, in a jar and you boil it and it evaporates? That's easy because water is just one compound. It's H2O. Easy. Crude oil is not like that. It's made up of many different thousands of compounds. So what happens is you would want to pass that, again, in a simple way, boil and pass it through what they call a crude distillation unit. It's that tall column you see. And you preheat this. When you heat it, it flashes. That's the term we use. Or it evaporates. Components of it evaporate. The lighter ends evaporate. So it gets into the refinery, the crude distillation unit, heated. And then the lighter ends, the vapor ascends, right? Now, the whole idea of distillation is that you want the vapor to make contact with the hot liquid at different levels of the column. You want enough surface contact so that heavier components in the vapor drop and only the lighter ones can go up and then be taken out, drawn out at different levels. All of that is a bit complex, but in the simple way, when that is concluded, you have different kinds of product at different levels, but they are still really raw at this point, which leads to making your refinery complex. If you want the best gasoline blends, gas oil, fuel oil, you need to have a complex refinery. Some of that is received as naphtha. It's either fed to a reformer, a straight run naphtha to a reformer. Some of the gas oil, you want to crack it in a catalytic cracking unit. After you finish cracking, some of the components you might want to hydro crack. So there are different components. It all leads all the way even the residual fuel, the heavy components of the crude oil. You don't just leave it like that because you're leaving money on the table. So what you do is they feed it to a vacuum distillation unit. A bit of science, right? The vacuum distillation unit is the reason you want to do that. You don't want to crack your crude oil in the CDU. Cracking is a term used to talk about when heavier hydrocarbon components break into lighter ones. So you see, you know, hydrocarbon is carbon, hydrogen,
yeah.
Typically.
Yeah.
When they break, you don't want to have that. Because if that happens, what you realize is if you have, let's say, 10 liters of your feedstock going into the refinery, if it starts cracking, at the end of the day, those 10 liters can yield easily 13 liters. The reason is because of the relationship between mass and volume. You have a volume going in, it's heavier, but it's occupying just a certain volume, X. Now, when it becomes lighter, different components, it's still the same weight, but the volume increases rapidly. So You want cracking to be controlled. So you take the feedstock into a cracking unit. No, into the VDU now, right? You take the bottoms into a VDU. The VDU is a vacuum distillation unit, right? Which means pressure is less, a lot less than the atmospheric pressure. It's usually between 3 to 5% of atmospheric pressure. And it's simple. You know, when you open a Coke bottle, you see what happens. It's not even a Coke bottle. Let's use beer, right?
Yeah.
Someone tosses you a bottle of beer and you catch it and then you pop the bottle open. What happens is the bubbles come up. You see gas, things like that. Now, that is exactly what happens in the VDU. That thing is vaporization, like it or not. Okay. But the reason is because the pressure is reduced. It expands. Mm. So that's what happens. Even without doing anything, once your crude feed from the bottoms of your CDU gets into the VDU, there's already some form of expansion, right? So you can achieve a lot more separation at a lower temperature, and cracking doesn't happen. But talking about LPG, the LPG is liquefied petroleum gas, so I will exclude methane from it. Methane is the lightest hydrocarbon that can be used, CH4. Yeah. It's what we call the natural gas, right? So I would exclude it and I'll just include ethane, methane, butane. That's from the C3, from the C2 to C4. Those ones are what qualify as LPG. And in a refinery, they are produced. It's not the primary way of having them, but they are produced in a refinery and they are drawn up from the CDU at the light ends. They're the lightest hydrocarbon. And once it passes through the crude distillation unit, your alkanes, generally are drawn off, you know, from C1 to C4.
Okay.
It stops there. Anything after that falls into light naphtha.
Okay. Wow. That's very, what a big interview. That's very interesting. Yeah. Even
it's myself. A lot more complex.
Yeah. Imagine. Like, it's very, thank you for this overview. And now I want to ask you another question, more geopolitics, but it's quite a logical question. I mean, what are the most common, the major events who impact the oil industry? Big like events like what the big impacts on the crude oil industry.
Well, we're not far away from one.
It's history. It's not geopolitics.
Yeah. In recent memory, no one is as big as the Russia-Ukraine invasion. Yeah. The Russian invasion of Ukraine. Sorry. That shook the oil industry, and I'm not just the upstream or the trading part. Every sector in the oil industry, because Russia is a key player. It's a very, very key player for Europe, for the rest of the world. And when that happened, that was, you know, the Europeans in America, that was where they drew the line. Okay, we don't want Russian supplies again. We'll have to punish them in some kind of way for this. So they placed certain kinds of embargoes, certain kind of trading restrictions, and that created new flows. All of a sudden, Russian gas that is supplied to Germany, to the rest of Europe, that ceased almost completely. And the rest of Europe had to find another way for it. All of a sudden, Russian crude started making its way to India at good discounts. The Chinese started buying Russian crude. It just turned around the dynamics of the crude oil world. You will see that because most international commodities are traded in USD, if the US places a sanction, you can't trade in that currency. You would get into trouble. I'm sure everybody knows this. But what happened now is certain countries decided to avoid using the USD to trade, right? Instead, trading directly in agreed currency with Russia. And it created new flows. Several companies started establishing offices in places like Dubai to be able to do this without getting into any form of, you know, regulatory problems. And I don't think the world has... We're recovering, right? We're recovering, but I don't think we have completely recovered from that. Mm-hmm. Another thing is COVID. I'm sure everyone saw what happened during COVID. I wouldn't say wonderful, but what happened shocked everyone. Mm-hmm. You saw crude oil prices fall to record lows during COVID. And that's simple. It's simple economics of supply and demand, right? Nobody needed crude oil products or petroleum products the way it was pre-COVID. Travel crashed to a record low. cars, automobiles, nobody was on the streets, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So everybody locked down in-house. China, a heavy, heavy demand center for petroleum products. Their longest lockdown. And you saw so many companies, trading, producing companies, storing crude oil. They would just store it in vessels and just leave it, you know? Because there's no demand.
So more like supply, we have to store all this crude oil. I mean, so we don't have, country who produce crude oil didn't have to, I mean, no one wants it, so how they can manage it. I mean, they just store it or they just stop the production, how it works.
Of course, there'll be rig counts decline. Some drilling platforms, producing platforms will take a step back. Countries will cut down on their supply because there's no demand. But the ones that have been produced already, what would you do with it? You have to store it somewhere. And we saw floating vessels scattered across the world, across the oceans of the world, laden, heavily laden with crude oil, just sitting. Certain companies took positions, you know, bought out storages in the Far East and China and just pumped it full with crude oil. And I mean, it offers, trading is all about arbitrage, right? It offers opportunities. In the midst of all the chaos, it also offered opportunities for certain companies. If you have the financial muscle to have multiple VLCCs and ULCCs in the water storing crude, then fantastic. You might have bought that crude oil product at, say, $20, $25 per barrel. And then when things start turning around, you can sell at the current price. Some people made a lot of money.
Yeah,
but COVID affected the oil and gas industry as we've never seen it before. So those two factors in recent history, the Russia-Ukraine war and COVID, really changed.
Okay, it's quite impressive. Okay, now we have nice picture of crude oil. You explained, first of all, West Africa. You explained how we produce crude oil. You explained the geopolitics impacts. Let's talk more about the different type of players in this industry. For example, crude oil operations. I think you work in operations,
yes.
If I'm correct. What are operations in this with these commodities? How it is? What kind of tasks do we have? What are the goals, etc.?
Well, I'm happy you asked. Well, operations is broad. There's no one way to look at it. But what you're trying to do as an operator is to ensure transaction completeness from beginning to end. So typically how it works is that let me use an example. Say your trader has concluded a deal and then your operator takes over immediately. So you look at the deal recap. You want to make sure that you draft a contract that captures those terms in the deal recap. You can't make a mistake around that. Your contract has to be watertight. And you do this for some companies, you do it in collaboration with your legal team. For some companies, you have contract departments that handle it. For some other companies, the operation teams handle it, right? But you, as the operator, you're dealing with everybody. You're dealing with the finance team. You're dealing with chartering. You're dealing with legal. You're everywhere. The vessel, many companies will have a chartering team. They would have fixed the vessel for it, you know. And then the operator has the job of instructing the vessel where to go. First of all, you need to know what kind of deal it is, what Incoterm it is. Is it FOB, is it CFR, is it CIF? All those things apply. They are very important. An example is, if it's CFR, for instance, and you're the seller, you know you have to arrange the freight for it, right? But if you're a seller and it's FOB, or the UK, the buyer should arrange his ship to come and load from you. So all of those things tie in. But as an operator, the easy way to look at it is that you have to ensure that the transaction is carried out exactly how the trader imagined it, or at least how he put it down in the trade recap. And that includes from the start, maybe let's say you're purchasing to sell to someone else, from the purchase, employing agents, inspectors, quality issues, all of that, up to the point where you deliver. Now, the delivery might be a separate Incoterm. It might be you deliver at place, you know. There are a lot of trading implications for that. you also make sure that post-transaction, everything is in order. So there's the talk of reconciliations, demurrage, you know, you make sure all of that happens seamlessly. So the operator's job is wide, and it's not easy to describe. Different companies will have different scope, but it's vast. And sometimes it ties in closely with business development as well, because I did that a bit, but
can't talk about that.
Sure. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's operations. What can you say about the difference between an operator and a trader? It can be like logical for people, but maybe if you go like deeply, what are the main differences in terms of the end goal?
Well, there are two different things in my opinion. The trader is always an originator. He's the one that brings the business, or should. I mean, there are instances where the business development team brings the business, very key role there. But typically, the trader, what he's trying to do is to make sure he gets value out of a specific transaction. He discusses the terms. He finds the arbitrage wherever it is, whether it's in the form of location arbitrage or you're looking at form arbitrage, maybe from crude to products. The trader's job is to ensure he gets that opportunity, that business, and then he has to also make sure that it's at the best terms that is possible at that time. It's not every time you win as a trader. You can take losses easily, but a good trader has to always, you know, make sure he gets value. For the operator, that is completely different. The operator sits happy, and when a trade is concluded, that's when he jumps in. The operator doesn't go before that. There's nothing to go for anyway. If a trade is completed and a contract needs to be signed, from that point, the operator comes in. He drafts the contract, makes sure everything the trader wants is represented in it, and carries it out. He's the one that is on the day-to-day. The trader does his stuff and he goes to sit down. He looks for the next immediately. But his operators will ensure completeness and seize it to the end. So mostly traders are originators, but they are pretty important because they bring the business.
Very interesting. On because we have operators for different types of commodities, a crude oil operator, is it like different? Do we have some specificities if you specialize on crude oil, or it's, I mean, every commodities you have, it's kind of the same job at the end?
Generally, I would say they have a similar structure, but of course, there are a few differences. Crude oil and, say, someone who is an operator on a chemical products trade, it's not the same because the products are not the same. But in general terms, it's the same thing. Yeah, all of operators, you'd be surprised at what they do. They're involved in financing as well. For instance, if your trade is backed by an LC, as an operator, you have a role to play in that. If it's open accounts, it's a different role. But for crude oil, in my opinion, I feel like crude oil is a bit simpler than certain petroleum products operations. I feel like crude oil is simpler, especially because of the region. In WAF, most of WAF, West Africa, crude oil purchases are typically FOB, right? And sometimes, not all the time, sometimes it's back to back. What that means is you already have a buyer, right? And that buyer wants the contract you have, or wants the product you have with the supplier. So you the deal you have with the supplier is on FOB basis. Then the deal you have with the buyer is on FOB basis. What that means is that you stand as the middleman sometimes. So what happens is that you don't charter the vessel. The buyer, your own buyer, charters the vessel and brings it to your supplier. So that keeps you in the middle, but it's not always like that. There are certain cases where you need to sell, CFR to someone. So you charter the vessel, you come, you lift the cargo, and then you handle it. But typically, in my opinion, crude oil trading, it's simpler just because it's a bit more established. It's well established and it's simpler. It's less dynamic.
Okay.
Interesting. So I think we covered it's quite good what you said. And now let's switch to new building. It's exactly what you are doing right now, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
With LPG. Can you explain what is it exactly? Are you what are you doing with LPG? It's like infrastructure, ships. What is
It's mostly ships. It's mostly ships, but there's a bit of infrastructure as well. The idea is LPG, the LPG market is, especially the shipping market around LPG, is not as developed as crude oil market or petroleum product market. You have vessels everywhere for this. You can get spots easy, right? But what we are seeing in these transient fuels, because LPG, LNG, I consider them transient fuels. What you're seeing with them is that for you to really trade effectively, you need a bit of equity. You need to, own assets. And that is what has necessitated my department. And what we do is we support our in-house LPG trading company by having the vessels. We build the vessels. And it depends on what business it is you're doing. It depends on what shots you have, what regions. That will determine the size, type, technology of the vessel you want. And typically, what you do is you get a shipyard. First of all, you have a mandate from your company, so you discuss with the shipyard, get the slot. Does it work for you? Does it not work for you? You have an outline specification, you look at it, you look at the price. Now, the shipping industry is one of the most regulated, in my opinion. It's heavily regulated, and you want to make sure that your new build stands the test of time. There are regulations that keep changing, keep getting introduced every day. So you want to ensure that in your outline specifications, in your detailed specifications, in all those components, you build to plan, not just for the current rules, for the ones that you might anticipate. So we've seen vessels now that we have a couple of vessels that are dual fuel, for instance. They can use the conventional fuels, they can use LPG. Then they're also ammonia ready, and that is one thing on the other side. There are vessels that already are using ammonia, and it's ridiculous because the tech for ammonia is still not robust. Even the regulation, I'll say, is still not robust. So it's going to take some time, but already some companies are pioneering that. They're moving. And it's a very technical field, right? It's very technical because a lot of the times you'll be looking at drawings. If you're looking at drawings, you'll be discussing engines or components and things like that. But it's interesting and it's important because it supports your business. Now, there's a bit of it that is also, assets that are not ships. Some of it could be storage, but those are very strategic. You need to know exactly why you're doing it because it's a lot of investment. You need to know exactly why you're doing it, where you're doing it, and what purpose it's going to serve. Some of these things, you have assets for business continuity reasons. It has the potential to go into something, but it will secure business for you in a certain region for many years, and that is why you do it.
Very interesting, what you say about building LPG vessel. What are the particularities of these vessels? Is it like more the tanks if you compare with a crude oil tanker, like a Suezmax, for example? If you build an LPG ship, what did you need to take into account to build this kind of ship?
The first thing you need to know is that the product you're conveying is a very dangerous product. It's extremely volatile, low flash, very combustible. And like I said, this industry is heavily regulated. So there's already an IGC code. There's an international gas code that you have to build to that specific minimum. It's the minimum. Generally, you build way above it, right? And then there are lots of conventions, SOLAS, and the rest that you have to observe. But in terms of, it's not the same as a crude oil vessel, a petroleum products vessel. They don't even have the same kind of containment. Generally, the containment system is different. You need several safety measures. You need a liquefaction plant on board, and I would say for LPG vessels, they are a lot more technical. A lot more technical because you're conveying really dangerous cargo.
Okay, clear. On, especially in the tanks, itself, do you think tanks are more obvious or the tanks, are they like robust or?
Oh, there are different kinds of tanks. Anyway, there are different classes of it, but the tanks are more robust. They are built with low temperature materials, which are more expensive, as you
Okay.
can imagine, and which are also subject to more regulations. And the containment, for instance, most of the vessels we have, the tanks don't form part of the hull in any way. You know, you're supposed to have a tank with the primary containment, a secondary hold space before the hull. So what you're trying to ensure is that in case of any damage, any breach, your cargo is contained, you don't have any spill. That is the primary thing, safety, you know, you don't have any kind of spill at all. So those vessels are quite complex. They might be smaller in scale. I mean, of course, they are LNG carriers that are
Yeah.
massive, right? But generally, compared to Suezmax, VLCCs, they are smaller in frame, but they're a lot more specialized with, you know, more specific materials.
Okay, very interesting. I want to say this is the end of the episode, but do you want to add something, maybe tips for like, I mean, maybe shipping professionals or like traders or operator? Do you have some tips to provide or?
Well,
Or anecdotes, you can share anecdotes as well about your journey in the industry.
it's a continuous thing. That's one of the key things I would say. I'm 8 years in, and typically that's not, I mean, there are people that have stayed a lot longer, right? But what I would say for anyone coming in, it's not specific to the industry. This is just general advice, and it works in every space. Be genuinely curious, you know, try to understand. No more than have the big picture mentality. If you're placed in a role, let's say you're an operator, try to know a bit more than that. Understand where you fit in comparison to the very big picture. It helps. And then staying curious also means you have to ask really important questions. It's, let's be very honest, it's a very cutthroat industry, right? And there are so many times there's hierarchy, lots of it. There are so many rooms you might not get into naturally, but if you are committed to learning and to asking important questions, there have been situations where just questions will bring you into certain rooms. So stay curious. You have to be patient because the industry requires patience. Yeah, you have to be patient. It's one of those industries where the apprenticeship system still works a lot. So you might have whatever you have in school and you come in, but you still need the experience. You still need to shadow someone. You still need to learn off them because experience, relationships, those things are big factors. So stay patient, really. And if you encounter any difficulties, don't take it personally. I would say
Okay,
that, yeah.
good one. Okay, thank you, Victor, for this episode. It was a pleasure to having you today. I think you provide us a lot of insights. So thank you again, and of course, I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you.